Okay, so we now start the second part of our ASAP meeting. I welcome everybody. A special welcome to Wu Chen, our new Chinese ASAP member, familiar face. She's been sitting at this table many times. She has taken over from Yan Zhao, who has become a member of this board. So, without further much ado, let's start with the agenda. We're first going to discuss primary financial statements. We have a presentation on gap measures by Kimberly Cruz. Kimberly.
Thank you, Hans. So I'm basically going to run through the slides. So just firstly, by way of introduction to the survey on the slide. Our objective of undertaking the survey was to find out the views of users on alternative performance measures. There had been some work done in New Zealand and elsewhere around what companies were doing, but we weren't aware of any research in the New Zealand context around what users thought. So we thought that this was a useful thing to do. We did the survey between November 2016 and January 2017. We did it in a quite simple way using a SurveyMonkey, a web-based survey tool. I should say we weren't intending this to be terribly scientific in terms of research methods or sample selection or anything like that. It was just something we did in-house. But nevertheless, we felt that the responses we got back are of interest. In terms of what we were meaning by alternative performance measures, we provided some definitions of that for the purpose of the survey, so that we were asking people to answer the questions using a consistent approach. And so we said that a gap measure was anything that was sitting on the face of the financial statements. That was a gap measure. And essentially an alternative performance measure or a non-gap measure was anything else. So any other number that might start with that and then add or subtract things or any other alternative performance measure. The other thing I should mention in terms of where you see alternative performance measures in the New Zealand context, they could be within the financial statements, occasionally on the face, as long as that obviously complies with IS1 requirements, or in the notes, but they're more commonly presented outside of the financial statements. So either in the management commentary in the front part of the annual report, or investor briefings, media releases, those types of investor communications. I should also say that we do have guidance issued by our regulator, the Financial Markets Authority, on the presentation of non-GAAP performance measures outside of the financial statement. So, and that guidance is very similar to the types of guidance that you'll see elsewhere in the world. So it talks about needing things like reconciliations and talks about prominence and how you're defining items, all those kinds of things. So that's important to bear in mind when we look through some of the responses. So in terms of the objective, it was really essentially to find out if they do find these measures useful or are confused, whether and how the presentation of what we do actually within the financial statements could be improved, and also whether people understand what those performance measures are and the related information that they receive as part of those alternative performance measures. Turning to slide 4, you can see the respondents here. We got 87 respondents overall, which in New Zealand context is actually a good response rate. We were very happy with the number that we got. You can see that the majority were individual equity investors, and I think that certainly reflects the help we got from the New Zealand Shareholders Association in disseminating the survey to their members. And that I think explains why we got so many in that user group. But again, we were very happy with that because it's typically a hard user group to get information from. So that's the responders. If you're wondering who's in the other category, there were people like regulators, other creditors, media commentators, some from the education sector, and a couple of chartered accountants. So the next slide asks for the level of experience of participants, and they basically self-assess their level of experience. And the reason for doing this was to see that when we got to the questions, would we get any difference between your expert users, so your professional users of financial statements and APMs, and your essentially non-expert users, so a prudent but non-expert user of financial information. And I should say these terms about a prudent but non-expert user, that comes from the way that our regulator looks at communication of information to investors. They basically have a principle that things like information that goes out in an IPO has to be understandable to a prudent but non-expert user. So somebody, which is similar to the idea I think that we have in the conceptual framework around somebody that's prepared to study the information with a reasonable degree of diligence but isn't necessarily a sophisticated user. In terms of the results, we actually didn't find any significant difference between the two groups of users. There was only one exception to that, and that which I'm not covering in this presentation, but there was one question about, have you ever asked a company for additional information about the alternative performance measure? And it was only the experts, the professionals, that had ever done that, which is, you know, understandable. Otherwise, they essentially had similar responses. 12% of other, their comments indicated they considered themselves somewhere in the middle, so more than a non-expert, but not necessarily as advisor. So the first question that we asked them was, are alternative performance measures useful? And you can see the results there, that if you add up those that said that that they were useful or sometimes useful, we ended up with 88.5% of respondents saying that. And so some of their comments around why they found it useful were things like, you know, it was most helpful, absolutely necessary. They said that this was helpful in understanding more about the underlying performance of the entity and its future prospects. Some commented about where there are valuation changes impacting on the company's performance. It was helpful in understanding essentially what the performance was, sort of excluding those sorts of valuation adjustments or what are called transitory earnings. So on the other side, we also had the other extreme. Some people were said no, they weren't. The 11.5%. And when you see their comments as to why they said that, they were really basically sceptical of the numbers. So they talked about that they've been used to massage the numbers, rosy glow of performance. So concerns about really is that a useful measure because of bias and other sorts of issues. So I thought that was an interesting result. The next slide then talks about which you find to be useful. Now, we gave them some suggestions around the types of APMs that we commonly see presented in the New Zealand market to see are they the ones that they find useful. And I guess it's in giving people things to choose from, are you then sort of pushing them down to, you know, tick that box, and so it's, I guess that's unclear as to whether that was the reason or that people prefer these measures anyway. But generally speaking, you can see that things like underlining or normalised profit, excluding sort of non-recurring or infrequently occurring unusual items, was helpful. EBITDA and EBITDAF, with the F being fair value measures. So. Essentially confirming that what is commonly provided is considered to be useful. We then asked the question, well, do you think company measures should be limited to gap measures? So I guess unsurprisingly, given the responses to the earlier questions about the usefulness of APMs, the majority said no, that it wouldn't be a good idea to do that. They thought that that the comments included things like, at the moment there's not enough line items on the face of the financial statements, and therefore APMs can provide you useful information that you're not getting from the financial statements, in addition to some of the other comments that I've made earlier around excluding particular items. And of those, as you might imagine, those that disagreed, it's mainly because they were concerned about the lack of consistency around how APMs were measured, sceptical about how the numbers were calculated. So I guess to sum it up once, somebody said APMs have their place. I don't think they should be given undue process and should be reconciled back to GAAP. and companies should be required to state why they're using them and be consistent, etc. But overall, they considered that they were useful and therefore did not want to limit it to gap measures. So we then asked this question, which I consider one of the most useful, most interesting results, really. What do you consider to be the primary indicator for assessing a company's report? Is it the gap measure? Is it the APM? Or is it both? And you can see that we ended up with, I guess it's not a big majority, but the majority saying that they wanted both. Well, both measures.
Is that a relief?
It was, really. So yes, I mean, obviously there are some people that primarily focus on the APM, and I guess that's because there were some comments around complexity of financial statements and not really necessarily understanding what's in the financial statements, and that's why they tended to use the APM. And those, of course, who primarily focused on GAAP tended to be in those camp that didn't necessarily trust the APM. But those who were more in the middle ground, which is the majority, thought they were useful but with caveats, and therefore they always wanted to have both kinds of information so that they could really assess the usefulness of the APM against the GAAP.
Now, Kimberly, you say, so the main reason why they would not just take GAAP as the primary indicator is... complexity.
Yes, some people felt that they weren't getting enough information through the financial statements, so things like not enough line disaggregation on the face of the statement, not necessarily understanding some of the numbers that were in the financial statements.
So that means that if we present better, that we could also regain some territory.
Yeah, I think so. We then asked about additional information that often accompanies GAAP measures, or explanations between GAAP and an APM. Is that useful? And again, we got the majority there saying really useful or usually useful. Some commenting that essential, vital, should be mandatory. Of those that said it was sort of in that bottom camp, that 20% or so, that said that it was not necessarily that useful. Some of their comments were around the information being ambiguous or inconsistent, complex or difficult to understand. And one saying that it being incomplete, they didn't have enough commentary to understand why those adjustments were taking place. I think that came through in other responses as well, where if you look at the regulator guidance, it does say that you should be explaining what the purpose of a particular APM is, but often that explanation is quite boilerplate. It says something like, we think this is a useful measure, alternative way of looking at our performance, without really saying, well, what was the objective of that measure? Why are you presenting that? So, and also that some of the other information is not being done in a consistent or helpful way. So, I think those people were not necessarily saying they don't want the information, they just want it to be done in a better way. We then asked for a question around, so turning to slide 11, around if we could do something in the around the usefulness of the information in a company's APMs, what kind of information do you think is the most useful? And again, we did provide this list for people to choose, and I think you can see that pretty much every suggestion we had there got a positive response, with the most positive being information around how the alternative performance measure is derived or calculated, comparing it to the previous year, and if you do change it from one year to the next, explaining why we've done that, so more information around that. Those were the most useful, followed by things like explanations for included or excluded items, the purpose, etc. So again, I think, you know, pretty logical things that people are looking for there. The next one was around accounting standards themselves, so thinking about what we're doing in the financial statements, what could we do, and again we gave some suggestions to people And you can see the majority there would support the basically getting more information in the financial statements. And in terms of what that might look like, there was support for things like a principle-based definition of operating profit, more subtotals in the income statement, standardised calculations of selected APMs, things like, which is again at the bottom of the page there, things like EBIT and EBITDA that are commonly presented, wanting that to be standardised, more disaggregation, and then definitions of terms are going to be used like non-recurring, one-off, infrequent. So I think a lot of that is actually quite consistent with feedback that the ISB has had from users elsewhere. And I suppose then if I could sort of sum it up to the overall what people were saying, I think there was support for alternative performance measures. They said that they were useful, but they are subject to caveats, that they want the APMs and are using them in conjunction with the GAAP measures as opposed to a substitute for GAAP. And again, I think as a standard setter, that's very helpful. You sometimes get these criticisms that people are doing these APMs because the GAAP is not giving you enough information, and while there's an element of truth to that, I think this does reinforce that people do want both types of information, and that's why it's so important that they're accompanied by reconciliations to GAAP and other explanatory information. So that was all I had to cover. I'm happy to take any questions, which I'll do my best to answer. If there's anything I can't answer, then we'll take a note and come back to you.
Just one question for clarification. The respondents were from New Zealand or broader?
New Zealand.
New Zealand. And the second question is, the financial statements they were reacted upon,
yes,
were global or just New Zealand companies?
I would imagine that it could be a combination of both. I'm not sure that we actually asked them. They were looking at companies' financial statements in New Zealand, but some New Zealand investors, of course, do invest internationally, so may have been looking at other types of financial statements, but I would imagine it's mostly New Zealand. I'll come back and confirm if that's incorrect.
And is there any guidance in or any best practice in New Zealand on how to format for the P&L, for instance? Is there anything that has been developed either through guidance or through best practice?
There is no, certainly from a standard setting perspective, we don't issue guidance on IFRS, so there's nothing that we have done. I mean, all of the firms, of course, produce their illustrative accounts, and I guess people look at that. But I would say practice in terms of how people present their financial statement is actually quite varied. Some people have gone through, what they call cutting the clutter, and maybe have reduced the amount, which is not, that appears on the face, which is not necessarily in some ways a good thing. But there is, varied practice in terms of how much information that people put on the face of the statement. And obviously, whatever they put on the face does need to comply with IAS 1. So if they're wanting to do some sort of alternative measure that you couldn't do and still comply with IAS 1, then clearly they wouldn't be able to do that on the face.
Yes, because that was the underlying question. Since you're mentioning that the APMs that you were talking about, or that on where you conducted the survey, on which you conducted the survey, are the ones that are not reflected in the financial statement, the primary financial statements.
That's right.
I just wanted to know if there was a variation in the presentation that would include part of the APMs in the financial statements, if some issuers wanted to express something via their presentation.
Yes, you do get some that do to the extent that they're able to. So, for example, you might get EBITDA or EBITDAF, where that's you can do that within the IAS 1 requirements, subject to making sure you comply with what's in IAS 1. But you do get some people putting EBIT or EBITDA EBITDAF on the face, or other types of earnings before interest tax. I've actually seen earnings before interest tax, depreciation, amortisation, fair value movements, impairment. They can be quite creative in what it's before.
And, okay, so and one last question. No comments on OCI?
No. No, we didn't specifically ask that, but no. No.
Thank you.
Most investors seem to ignore OCI.
Yeah, but that's what I wanted to know.
Anne?
Kimberly, did the reconciliations refer to the segment note at all? Because some of those subtotals you mentioned, like EBIT and EBITDA, may also appear in the segment note. So in the reconciliations, do you know if the preparers were tying up the segment subtotals as well?
We didn't ask people that because we weren't necessarily focusing on how companies have calculated that. We were just asking for users' views. So, the reconciliations that are required under the FMA guidance are basically to reconcile to the, whatever number you've done to the GAAP number. I don't believe it actually specifically refers to the segment note.
Russ.
So that, well, yeah, there is something in the guidance around we would expect there to be, if you're doing whatever you're doing in a segment, there ought to be some correlation between what your segment profit sort of looks like to what you're doing in your APMs.
So thank you for the presentation. I did give it to our team that is working on financial performance reporting. The overall observations are somewhat consistent with the research that we did leading up to our recent agenda decision on performance reporting. That is that it shows that GAAP is relevant and alternative performance measures are relevant. What we found in the U.S. is consistent with that. We also found in the U.S. that while what's on slide 12 would all be potential solutions to help solve the problem, there aren't consistent views, at least in the U.S., about what would be operating profit, whether or not EBIT or EBITDA should replace gross margin. And what we found is that what would be perhaps a final step or an interim step would be more lines, which is, I think, what you talked about. What my fundamental question is on the 18% on slide 9 that don't find alternative performance measures helpful, is were you able at all to get into the detail and determine, is that, when they're talking about those alternative measures, are they talking about the alternative measures that are derived directly from the books and records, i.e. EBITDA? Or are they talking about unique measurement items that management has created? So in the U.S., it is common to back out certain things that you just didn't want to be an expense, i.e. stock comp, right? But it is derived directly from a books and records. When you find management creating their own measurement category, that is when there is less confidence. In other words, the way I interpret that is when it is derived directly from an internal control structure, from an auditing structure, users are more likely to consider it. When it is a pure management creation, they discount substantially. And I didn't know if you'd gotten into that detail. That's good.
No. I mean, we really just asked, as you can see, the question that's on the page, that was the only question we asked. And as I mentioned earlier, some of the reasons why that people aren't using it are those that are really skeptical about what management is doing and don't really believe that they're necessarily portraying a full picture of their performance, and they questioned what some of the adjustments were. So even though they could sort of see the adjustments, like I can recall, one comment was, why are you adding back depreciation and amortization? They're a part of your business. It's not valid to add those back. So there were those sorts of people that were very cynical in that.
Okay, thank you.
Russ, when in the case, very common in the back out stock options expenses. What are the SEC requirements then? Just a reconciliation, or do they also have to make clear in the definition of the item that the expenses are excluded? So net income.
First of all, with respect to stock-based compensation, the number of companies backing out is being reduced over time. Some very prominent investors have said that is not right. But when a company has a non-GAAP, and we have GAAP, we have non-GAAP, and we have other alternative performance measures. So the non-GAAP is a specific legal distinction, and when you have non-GAAP, you have to reconcile that from GAAP. It can be no more prominent than GAAP. right? And if you change it, you have to describe that you change it. And the SEC has made it a priority to ensure that there's been compliance with these pre-existing rules and regulations that came into play a number of years ago, right?
Andreas.
Thanks, Hans. My question follows from Russ's. I think if we go to the overall observations, I think I would agree with them and they resonate with what we hear in Germany. However, there's one point that I would like to flag, and that concerns the second and the third. The second, supplement versus substitute, and the third one, reconciliation. I think it's probably easy to reconcile once you just back out something, because then you've just added back. The question is, have you had any comments on what I would call timing differences? And the example I give there is the classic banking levy. So it's still creating some noise. So it concerns banks that per that legislation have to build the entire liability as of day one. And therefore, in the first quarter, they have the entire hit on expense. Yet they just believe that it should be spread out over the year evenly. So they come up with an alternative number. So to reconcile that number back to the gap figures might be difficult because there is not a real anchor. Yeah, you cannot just deduct or add back, but you really have to multiply. You have to perform certain calculations. And the question that I have is twofold. One, do you hear similar concerns in your country, or have analysts raised this issue? And the second point is, when we hear this comment, there seems to be an underlying notion of the preparer community. The APM is really the better number. And I think that's where it becomes difficult, because then you're almost in the override question in IAS 1. Because if you say in IAS 1, you substitute the gap number, put in what you believe is the better number, then it comes with all sorts of disclosures and explanations and justifications and the like. And if you try to circumvent that, you just leave the gap number as there, but then you present with similar prominence, not equal prominence, but probably slightly less prominence, but still prominent, the number that you believe to be the right number. Have similar concerns been voiced in New Zealand?
Yeah, so to answer your first question, I'm not aware of issues around the reconciliation. I think that it's been an FMA in their guidance, they basically say you have to provide the reconciliation, so I guess that does sort of down to people that route. And it's something we could certainly look into. It would be interesting to follow up with the FMA around, because they're obviously looking at how people are doing this and has that come up. So it would be interesting to follow that up. Your second point about, yes, people wanting to say that the APM is the better measure, and I've done this because GAP's not really telling my performance story and this is what I want to do. That certainly is, from a preparer perspective, very much a strong view. And recently, when the FMA modified or looked at the guidance that they have on non-GAAP measures, one of the things that they've actually recently done is adjust the guidance on prominence, because they were concerned that there was this prominence given to the non-GAAP measure and people were talking about it and basically ignoring the gap, but it might be sort of like a tiny line at the back of the presentation or whatever what the GAAP number was, and not really talking about it. And so they've now said that has to be equal prominence of the two numbers, so they are actually trying to address that concern.
Andrew.
Thank you. Thanks very much for the study. And like others, the overall messages seem very consistent with what we've been hearing in Europe, that APMs are, first of all, widespread, that many people find them useful, but they need to be done right. So, put it in imprecise terms. So a couple of questions. So we sort of touched on this a bit already, but I just wanted to clarify. You stated that for this survey, you instructed people to assume it was a gap measure if it was on the face of the primary financial statements. So is that because you're assuming that if it's on the face, it must be compliant with IAS 1, and therefore it becomes a gap measure even though it's not explicitly defined?
Yes, we basically defined GAAP as taken directly from a line item or a subtotal that is presented on the face of a company's financial statements. For example, profit before tax, profit for continuing operations, profit for the year. So we did, and yes, there is an assumption if it's there on the face that has complied with GAAP, because one would hope it does.
Yeah.
You could question that, but one would hope.
Well, certainly hope that. That's a good hope. And then, back on the reconciliation, I think on slide 11, 51% of respondents thought it was useful to reconcile to the closest equivalent GAAP measure. So, yeah, that's not bad, but it's sort of down there in the lower part of the table in terms of usefulness, whereas the reconciliation is often described as one of the critical things you need to do to provide a fair presentation of an APM. So I was a little surprised it didn't sort of score higher. I wondered, and I'm going to ask you to speculate if you might not want to do, if that's because given how few GAAP measures are actually defined in IFRS right now, there isn't a whole lot to reconcile back to. Or you can be reconciling back to something that's actually not all that close to the APM that you're using.
Yeah, I mean, I would be speculating as to why, unless people felt that the first one about how it's derived or calculated was sufficient without necessarily the detailed reconciliation, because they are quite similar, those two.
Yeah.
But maybe they didn't need to see the calculation as long as they understood it. I'd be speculating. Yeah.
Thank you.
Kim.
Thanks, Hans. Yeah, thanks, Kimberly. I also found this very interesting. The one thing that I wanted to ask is, well, if you look at the financial statements, obviously you've got your GAAP measures in the financial statements, and then there could be the alternative performance measures. But in New Zealand, outside of the financial statements, are there requirements to always at least have the GAAP measures together with the alternative performance measures in press announcements and that type of thing? Or is it possible to simply only have the alternative performance measures?
Well, if you follow the guidance from our regulator, you do have to have both. And so the guidance I was talking about applies outside of the financial statement, so it applies to those press releases, shareholder briefings, and all of that. So whenever you're including an APM in those measures, you are required to have the GAAP measure as well. And as I mentioned, you can't give that greater prominence now.
Yes.
To the...
To the APM.
To the APM, along with a whole set of other requirements around reconciliation.
Yeah, that's interesting, because in South Africa, until very recently, companies had to, for their press announcements, actually had to, well, and I guess as the name implies, it's in the press, it's in the newspaper, etc. And then they got to the point where they've now said that you can have a short form announcement. And only, you know, in the public, you know, domain. And then users can then go and look elsewhere to find the actual sort of, you know, interim financial statements. And recently, just, you know, I picked up the newspaper and had a look at some of these short forms. And there you see things like our operating profit, and then you see even an item called operating profit before special items. Those things are not defined. And again, what is operating profit? So looking at this particular short form, there was no indication of what the net profit was from a GAAP perspective. You only had all these alternative performance measures. And also when you then listen to the results of companies being discussed, you know, on financial shows and things like that, again, they're just talking about this information. And I said to one of my colleagues, you're looking at this, you think, okay, well, they've done pretty well. But you actually have no idea at the end of the day if all these special items all happen to be losses, and at the end of the day they've made a loss, because they haven't disclosed what these special items are.
Is a short form a regulatory requirement?
So it is now. So as opposed to having what previously used to be required, where at least you would see the GAAP numbers, they only are now required to give some minimum requirements. And
better have a talk with the regulator.
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah. That to me, it really was very surprising that you look at this information and you say, well, I don't even know what the net profit was of this company.
I guess ours was the opposite experience, and that's what we used to have.
Yes.
Used to have, because it wasn't regulated at all, and so people were just doing the APMs, and that was the objective of the regulator issuing the guidance to fix that.
So I think that's something which we need to pick up. Thank you.
Linda.
Thanks. So we found this particularly interesting because this topic is taking up a lot of my time, and we're discussing at the board level as well in Canada. I think I've alluded at the last couple of meetings. About a year ago, we had a great big article in the press which took on a bit of a life of its own, gap versus non-gap, and a research study that was done by an equity firm around the proliferation of non-gap measures, the fact that non-gap measures are almost always more favorable than the gap measures, et cetera. That started out an initiative. Our audit regulator got into it with our audit board in Canada. Subsequently, I got engaged. We did some panel discussions in February with some very senior users, both buy side and sell side. So now this activity is building. We ultimately did interviews with all of those senior investors, and on Monday, when I get back, we're going to have a meeting about the debrief from all of that, where all of those same parties will be involved, including CPA Canada from an education perspective for membership. And on Wednesday, I'm speaking in Montreal to a group of CFAs about the same topic. They wanted a sexy title for the presentation, so what the staff came up with was gap and non-gap, will this marriage survive? That's about as sexy as I think we can get. But anyway, taking up a lot of discussion in Canada, so a few observations in terms of where we are relative to your study, and happy to share information. So on slide 9, I was interested to see that 20% say they only use GAAP, because so far we haven't found any analyst who only uses GAAP by their own admission. So that was interesting, and that was about the only thing that was inconsistent. On slide 11, very consistent, not perhaps by number, but the themes that you've got there are very consistent with our discussions. In particular, the notion of the statement on whether or not the APM has been subject to any assurance. What was interesting about our discussion so far is that there seems to be a very low level of awareness that once you move from GAAP to non-GAAP, that there's an idea that the auditors look at that. And once you move beyond to what they tend to not use the terms alternative performance measures, they tend to talk about KPIs. And you move into that arena, it's kind of a wide open arena, and they have very little awareness how quickly you move from the structured regime where you have the financial statements and the assurance into the arena where the information is completely not subject to any assurance, and had no idea whether or not the entity involved actually had any governance processes over those particular numbers that were disclosed. And in particular, the theme that has come back, though, that I think is relevant to the work that's being done by the IASB is what analysts are telling us is that they need these alternative performance measures or KPIs, but they feel very strongly that they're only relevant if they're defined by industry. And so the issue becomes is if you move from an EBIT or an EBITDA, that thing I think can be generically described. And one could argue that you already have that guidance in IS1 if people actually, you know, were true to it, but anyway. But then you move beyond that, it becomes very specific around, well, in telecommunications, they want number of subscribers, they want cost of acquisition, you get into same-store sales. The real estate industry has a litany of KPIs that they have developed in the industry in Canada. And so I think the discussions that we have are going to morph into what would we do locally about that arena, because we don't think it's necessarily the subject of what you're trying to achieve in the primary financial statement project. But I don't know where it's going to land, but it looks like what we have to do is discuss it and decide whether or not we're going to take any local action around giving structure or education, and the audit guys will then take it off and decide if they're going to do any auditing of that stuff. All said, it's very clear that the other thing we asked them was how much reliance do you place on the audited financial statements versus everything else you look at? And I have a slide that shows that they say about 20% of what they use is audited financial statement or derivation thereof, and 80% comes from an unaudited outside of the financial statement domain, which is interesting. The point being that if you're going to do work in this, I think what you have to decide is set your scope very carefully and understand what you can achieve within the confines of IFRS versus what can be achieved elsewhere. which is, I think, a message that I've talked about other times. They do say, though, the same people say, though, that the bedrock of what they do is knowing that the financial statements are there. When you try to push them to ask if they reconcile things to the financial statements, you get varying degrees of answers. Some say, well, every now and then we do it. Some seem to don't know whether the information they're using outside the financial statements actually does ultimately reconcile to the financial statements. That's germane to that notion of the importance of the reconciliation. So the more sophisticated ones seem to really rely on the reconciliation versus others who don't quite have that level of awareness of where the reconciliation might be. On slide 27, what we found interesting is there seems to be some idea that the standard setters in general, and they don't really differentiate between the accounting standard setter and the auditing standard setter, could be helpful if they could provide some structure around these areas, although some of them will say that don't tell us what's non-recurring or one-off because we'll figure that out ourselves. So it's very interesting. But overall, I think these themes are very important to us as standard setters and to the relevance of the financial statements. So just some things from Canada's perspective.
Thanks, Sue.
Thank you. We believe the results are very suggestive of county standards. Some results of the survey on the page 12, especially, seem to be very common in the jurisdictions of the ESG area region. In particular, it shows that the user's desire for a definition of operating profit, more disaggregation of information, and information on non-recurring items, which are observed in other jurisdictions in this region as well. But I wonder, some people are thinking only APMs to be defined reliably, applied consistently, and comparable should be included in the financial statements. So I wonder how the respondents think about the comparability of the APMs, the understandability of the APMs. I think it's very difficult to compare APMs among the entities because those are non-GAAP. There's no criteria how to understand the criteria set by the management. Yeah. Very difficult to compare the non-GAAP and the GAAP. So I wonder how the respondents are thinking about that issue.
I think that is one of the issues that came through in terms of consistency of how the numbers are being calculated. And I think that's reflected in some of the feedback we got around wanting standardised definitions of certain APMs, because there was concern that people were calculating numbers in very different ways. So it was difficult to compare one company to another using the APM because of that lack of standardisation. So I think that is consistent with some of the feedback that we got.
Two questions. The first thing on slide 7, you said that investors would favor mainly three forms of APMs, which is underlying, normalized, etc., EBITDA, EBITDA. It is the case that under these umbrellas, there are several different performance measures. I mean, because what happened in Brazil is that people just call EBITDA, but there was several variations of that, so that's why the commission required people to reconcile. It's not because they are far away from GAAP, but because there are so many things being called EBITDA. So you see the same thing.
And we certainly get in New Zealand people using these standardised labels, but not necessarily calculated the same way. So I think that was part of the reason we got that feedback for consistency, particularly with things like EBITDA. Once you go beyond EBITDA, or you're calling something EBITDA, but there's other things in it. So you commonly, you might see some EBITDA or EBITDA, but then impairment has also been removed. Yeah, well, that's not actually one of the the factors. So I think that is consistent. And that's why there is people asking for standardised calculations of these terms, so that EBITDA, for example, always means the same thing.
Okay, I see.
The second is, given that, do you see a movement to increase the non, because this is sort of gap-related APM. Do you see the movement towards more non-gap-related APM? I mean, like number of downloads, number of clients that went to a store, or things like that. That's very hard to because number of downloads on a web page. How do you reconcile that with gap? Because there's no accounting measure really. It's not revenues, but it's an important performance indicator. Do you see that happen?
I guess for the purpose of this survey, we've focused more on the standardised, if I can use that term, the more common types of alternative performance measures, which are, you know, things like operating profit, normalised profit, that kind of thing, as opposed to some of the other information that you're providing. We didn't specifically ask people about those types of performance.
I understand that, but
I would only be speculating.
From your experience, do you see this as an issue?
I think once we start getting into that, we are getting into, so I guess, wider corporate reporting more generally, and people are starting to provide those types of information. It's very varied in practice as to what people are doing. So some will do nothing at all, they'll just stick to the absolute minimum. Others will go further, and there isn't any real guidance out there around what people should be doing.
Tommaso.
Kimberly, thank you for your presentation. And looking at the slides, I think that the question was very well structured and possibly very, very pragmatic in the question raised. We had a meeting conference with our users on this topic last year, so a bit dated, but the input we received were very aligned to the responses, so the usefulness of these indicators and the need for better understand that they are read it by users and all this stuff. One of the points that was under discussion at the conference was about whether these APMs, what about an issue close to the comparability issue that sounds to raised before. You know, the APM are not really just a problem of what the APM are and what the ingredients to measure this APM are, but how much ingredient I use to measure it. So, I mean, for example, EBITDA, you can have EBITDA adjusted, and EBITDA adjusted means that I could adjust the items for calculation or how much item, no? There are some industries in which the way they manage the stock, for example, means that they adjust the measurement of the stock. Other industries do something else. And I'm not going through the difference between financial and non-financial to be too easy. But between industrial, probably, there's a way they calculate the difference. And my feeling was that within an industry, it's important to have a sort of comparability of these measures. But across industries, I wouldn't say it would be a nightmare, but it would be very difficult, because even if we say you have to measure EBITDA in this way, then, you know, I will continue to express my EBITDA using, you know, how much stock or, you know, revaluing the stock in a way or not. So that is why my question raised about slide 12, when I see the standardized calculation of selected APM was one of the items supported by 2/3 of the participants. Do you think that when they say standardized, that they want standardized across industries or within industries, or was an item that wasn't touched by the survey?
We didn't specifically ask that question. I guess the closest I can think of, we did get some comments around, and it was more that people didn't necessarily see EBITDA as being useful in some industries. The usefulness of EBITDA itself depends on the industry. And I think that was people meaning if you're a capital-intensive industry, then you shouldn't be adding back, you know, depreciation and amortization. But we didn't sort of ask specifically around what types of adjusted EBITDAs per industry would you like of it. So we just got the more broader comment around wanting the, some standardisation.
Thank you, Kevin. I have the same feeling with others that this research is very interesting and very helpful. And especially the slide first, I have the same feeling with others that this slide is very useful and meaningful. I'm thinking that as the standard setter, what shall we do and what can we do in this area? I think that's very important to define the scope of the project. I believe that the ISB is undertaking the primary financial statement and the other projects, the so-called better communication. I think that's reflect some of the points in the 12. For example, the fourth one, the second one in the slide 12. And that's one comment. And another comment is that I'm thinking that if I want to define more APMs as the standard setter, that would be a big challenge. For example, we all recognize that the operating profit or EBIT or EBITDA are very useful for the users. But do we need to meet all the needs of the users? Because sometimes they can use the data from the financial statement to make their own calculation. And for the standard setter, it's really difficult to give a clear definition of some of the items. For example, the usual and unusual items, the frequent or infrequent items, the non-recurring items and recurring items. And also, we also need to take the regulators into account. Because in different jurisdictions, the regulator, they did have an impact on some of the APMs. So even we make a clear definition in standards, but in different jurisdictions, there still might be diversity in practice because it's worse, it will be affected by the regulators. So our preliminary suggestion is that maybe as the standard setter, we just provide some principle-based definition for some selected or important APMs and allow some flexibility in each jurisdiction for the practice. That's preliminary comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes. The standard setter, I would agree with a lot of that.
I just had an associative thought about the interviews with football coaches after matches and how often they also give underlying results and normalized scores. If we take out all the bad luck that we had, we would have won.
That's right. Yeah.
If we take out all the bad referee decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
And unfortunately, we just keep the score.
I think.
Listening carefully to the debate and also having reviewed the outcome of this survey, which is very interesting, I think it re-emphasizes the importance of what we discussed here in ASAF a number of times. A course of action has to be decided. Either we take the conservative look that too touchy, too specific, let the companies organize as long as the regulators impose a reconciliation, an explanation, a reasonable consistency, which which is one course of action. The other course of action, which is a little more tricky maybe, is for the standard setters in general to try to find a common platform and a bridge between financial information as per the primary statements and alternative financial information, which is in fact derived, as you mentioned, Russ, in most cases, not always, from the financial statements. So it's like in skating, you have a freestyle skating, and you know the, I don't know how you say that in English, the imposed figures. Okay, so. And we have to at a point in time, I think a consensus is needed on which of the two options IFRS could follow.
Well, I think, Patrick, that we believe that we need to take a bit more progressive action and at least provide some more anchors in the income statement, especially. Without having
so you would take back into the financial statements some of the APMs, maybe the ones that are more straightforward in terms of subtotals, but when you get to normalized profit, it becomes a little more complex.
So the point where we are at is that we feel we probably can do something EBIT-like, but normalized profits is much more difficult. Perhaps we can find a way to present it better in the statements or give more guidance. I think we should do something because it's so prevalent, but there we are still much more hesitant. But even the simple one of EBIT, you would think it's simple, it's not simple at all.
No. My point was, the conclusion was, yeah. Consensus is needed on this one. Let's be careful. I am personally in favor of making sure that APMs are not developing in a way that would impair comparability. It's absolutely essential information. You know, I think that analysts would go first to the APMs. Management is certainly relying a lot on APMs. That's my personal experience. We have to be very careful that the normalized pension information is not something, you know, that is left aside, and then the commentaries are on, you know, of course they take this as a starting point, but then they develop a lot of literature on what is not normalized.
So I was going to, I think your observation about there's really two paths. One is to provide more disaggregation, or require more disaggregation, more lines, more information. And then there's the other one about that plus the additional structure. And I just want to second what Linda said, is that what we found in the U.S. is on the structure standpoint, there are common metrics by industry. There are not common subtotals by all.
Yeah.
And so the difficulty of that, and I know it seems easy to define EBIT or EBITDA, and I know it's not easy, but also EBITDA or EBIT is not a common metric across all industries.
Right.
And so in the FASB, we felt that it was probably more efficient to improve the information by having more disaggregation and focusing on that rather than focus on both, because we felt we would get bogged down on the subtotals because of the industry,
right,
and because there wasn't a common subtotal out there.
And we are also looking at that.
Yeah.
But as part of what? As a note to the account?
No, actually what we added was in performance reporting to look at improving the income statement by having more line items by nature, by function. We also added a project on improving segments, which is a management non-GAAP, to have more information, more columns, if you will, more segments, and more information there. And it'll be interesting if we are able to complete that, well, you have a difference between what management uses to manage the business on a non-GAAP basis versus what management discloses to outsiders on a non-GAAP. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You'd think that'd be consistent, but I'm with those 18% on that one.
The remuneration gaps are very similar to what is used to the outside world.
The issue of compensation is quite important.
That is where a lot goes wrong. Anyway. Okay, well, thank you. It was a good discussion, Kimberly. I give the floor to Andrew.
Thank you, Hans. Good morning, everybody, and thanks to ISB for the invitation to come along this morning, and also for their help and support throughout this project, because we've discussed the development of the paper with the various advisory groups at ISB at various times, and we've really had quite a lot of input. I'm aware of the time, so I'll just go through the slides really very swiftly and just try to bring up the main points. In doing so, of course, I will often have to resort to assertions, underlying arguments. I will skip over happily all that background, both of the discussion paper and the responses is generally available. So moving to slide two, I think one of our key principles was that we suggested the cash flow statement would be a better thing if it reported cash flows, which it doesn't at the moment. There might be cases where you have notional cash flows included. We felt that was not appropriate. And also it includes a reconciliation of operating activities, which has things in it like depreciation, which doesn't seem to be a cash flow. And therefore we suggest that the reconciliation should not form part of a statement that calls itself a statement of cash flows. We also looked at the definition of cash and cash equivalents and decided that it was being fairly evident that it's a very old definition. It manages to be both vague and arbitrary at the same time, which is quite an achievement. And we felt that it would be better if we focused on cash. Those principles have some corollaries, some of which are brought out on slide three. We didn't really go back to first principles in the sense of saying, well, what sections would we like? We sort of started from having operating, investing and financing, which is, as you know, what IS7 already does. But we did find it odd that given that people find operating activities to be a particularly useful number, that it's simply a residual. And so we suggested, I know that it's controversial, that operating activity should be defined or described, that it should be consistent between the P&L and the cash flow statement, and that the reconciliation should be at the operating level, which apart from anything else, because although I said the reconciliation should not be in the cash flow statement, we were very clear that we needed a reconciliation. But if it's between operating profit and operating cash flows, it should be shorter and therefore more understandable. We also suggested that purchase of PPE should be reported as an operating item, because basically you buy PPE for your operations, but that there should be a subtotal before and after the inclusion of investment in PPE. And we noted that that seems to have some interesting effects in that the total before PPE has got some resemblance to EBITDA. It's not identical, of course. And after the deduction of capital investment, you get to something which is pretty close to what many people regard as free cash flow. Because we thought that operating should be defined, it follows there must be some items that are non-operating, and we suggested there should be a separate section for that, and also for tax. Management of liquid resources. I said that we thought that cash should be the thing that's reported in the cash flow statement, but we felt that it would be very useful to have a separate section that indicates how management manage their liquid resources. And we suggested that could be defined really quite broadly. I think we did say that it would be useful to say that they should be liquid, to put some sort of discipline on it, but not much more than that. Moving on to slide four, We got responses. We were quite pleased with the responses. 22 is not a large number, but the quality of the responses was really quite impressive. We thought we got 3 from standard setters, several from groups of preparers and from groups of users, and so on and so forth. They were overwhelmingly from Europe. And what did they agree with? Well, to my mind, the most important thing that they agreed with, and I admit they're a self-selected sample, is that they thought the cash flow statement was important and that there was room for improvement. And I think that's really quite a strong message. They also agreed that we shouldn't have notional cash flows, and that operating activities should be defined and, or described. Interest on financing liabilities should be within financing was one of our proposals. That's kind of shorthand. I said a lot of this is shorthand. We distinguished, or we suggested, that there should be a distinction between interest on debt, frankly, and interest on operating activities. So, for example, if you routinely buy your inventory on deferred terms, then that might be operating interest, or interest on an operating provision might not be within financing. But there were a number of areas where views were mixed, as we set out on slide 6. The idea of putting PPE within operating activities got a fair bit of pushback on that, as did the idea of changing the definition of cash and cash equivalents and moving the reconciliation. Now, I said that a number of the responses were really quite high level, and obviously this is only my take, and I do invite people to form their own views, but I thought a lot of people who disagreed in these areas really didn't give much more of a reason than that, well, we quite like what we've got and we just don't want to change, which is, of course, a justification, but perhaps it's not really the strongest. So that is the sort of summary of the summary, so to speak. It's highly condensed. And slide 7 is my attempt to summarise some recent decisions from IESB in this area. So with that, I will hand over to Michelle.
Okay. We provided a paper 2C, which just provides the staff initial view about how we might consider the feedback received by the FRC on the discussion paper as part of our project. We haven't discussed these initial views with the board yet. The staff will be considering all the feedback that the FRC received and developing proposals for the board about whether we think the board should be considering those. However, the board has tentatively decided to focus on targeted improvements in this project, with a particular focus on the statement of financial performance. And therefore, we think it's perhaps unlikely we want to extend the scope of the project to cover a very comprehensive look at IS 7. However, this wouldn't mean we'd ignore the feedback, but more if we did take a more comprehensive look at IS 7, it might be better done as part of the project or as a separate project. I think in the interest of time, it may be worth moving to the questions. And the first question we'd like to ask ASAP members is, what, in your view, are the implications of the FRC discussion paper for the board's project on primary financial statements? The questions are at the end of the agenda paper too.
Alex? I have a question one step back. Do you intentionally exclude the financial institutions from the discussion or not?
That's correct. We were, I think to some extent it was a decision that gave me some relief. But also we were fairly keen not to duplicate work that other people were doing. And so there are a couple of examples of that. And at the time that we were working on this, FRAG was working on financial institutions. So rather than confuse the debate by having views that might be similar or might be different coming from different places, we were explicit that our work did not address financial.
Because the main comment from my jurisdiction, at least from Brazil specifically, was the people generally agree with cash flows are, statement of cash flows are important, except for the financial institution. And the fact that a Basel committee is issuing new regulations like liquidity recovery ratio, it's APM, some sort of APM, is because the statement of cash flows of an institution, they do not work at all. So they have liquidity recovery ratio and net stable funding ratio, which could be this information that could be on a proper statement of cash flows, if the statement of cash flows are prepared. So I believe that's the main criticism about the current status of statement of cash flows.
Andrew, you said that there were mixed views about including PPE in operating expenses, operating cash flow. But this seems to be a yes or no. Rather operating or investing. Did someone raise the point that there might be a distinction that normal replacement should be in operating, a major investment on a major line of business, different products should be real investment?
That's certainly quite a popular view, that certainly there should be a distinction between those two classes. We discussed it in the discussion paper and noted some of the practical issues that would arise with that. So our conclusion, or the suggestion made in the paper, was that it's pretty hard to improve on what IAS 7 already does, which is to encourage a split rather than require it. The exact balance of the responses I'd have to go back to check on. But yes, I mean, there's certainly a view that some people would very much like to see that split made.
Kim.
Thanks, Hans. Thanks, Andrew. Just a comment and a question around the notional cash flows and also sort of what is, you know, operating versus financing. And I think, you know, at face value, it's easy to say, well, the cash flow statement should only have, you know, real cash flows. But I think it also goes back to the main purpose and objective of the cash flow statement, because you could have businesses effectively, you know, conducting their activities in different ways, yet sort of achieving the same or similar outcome. So even the example that you used just now around saying, well, you might, you know, typically buy stock on credit, and then that interest would effectively be part of operating. Now, if you didn't actually buy the stock on credit from your supplier, but you used bank borrowings, overdraft, bank loans or whatever, again, you sort of are achieving the same financial result, yet what is that interest? Is that now operating interest, or is that financing interest? So I think, you know, it does go back to what is the objective, and to what extent should substance over form play a role in the cash flow statement. So, you know, again, I guess it's also the question around, you know, again, buying equipment on credit or leasing it from the supplier versus borrowing money and paying cash. A few years ago, I was very intrigued. In South Africa, there were a lot of, I wanted to call them schemes, but maybe that's, you know, not quite the right word, but approaches where the banks were very keen to help companies effectively settle their creditors. Mm-hmm. And then the bank is effectively financing that, and wasn't really sort of sure, well, what was driving this? And again, is it to show better cash flows from operating activities, because you're saying, well, I'm actually getting all this cash in, or the cash is going out, whichever way it's going, and then the cash gets put somewhere else, whereas somebody else is, you know, they're not involving a bank or a third party. You know, at the end of the day, well, you know, what does all of this mean? And so I think we must be careful not to quickly dismiss this concept around saying, well, you know, there shouldn't be notional cash flows. But I think we need to look again at, well, what are we trying to reflect in the cash flow statement? And what role does substance over form play in some of these decisions?
If I could very briefly respond to that, I know this won't be a completely satisfactory answer, but I think it's always been very clear that in our work that despite the fact we spend some time thinking about cash flow statements, it's not because we think the cash flow is the be-all and end-all of financial reporting and is the most important thing in the world. We try to be as clear as possible that actually the P&Ls
got an awful lot to be said for it, and the balance sheet's probably not useless either. in those statements, you do, for example, you're following IFRS 16 quite rightly, say, well, if you lease something, it's a bit like buying it. I mean, accounting is really very similar. But from a cash flow perspective, they're obviously very different. And that's what the cash flow statement can portray. So that's a very brief, as I say, probably not totally satisfactory answer, but I think that's the perspective.
Andrew.
Thank you. Thanks again, Andrew, for the discussion paper and the feedback. I'm afraid we didn't respond, ZEFRAG, so we haven't taken a view on the particular recommendations. But I was pleased to see that the ISB staff proposed to consider them carefully and decide what to bring to the board. And I think overall, we'd look at focused, targeted improvements to IS7 rather than a fundamental pull-up-the-drains overhaul is the right way to go. But most of these suggestions seem to fall into the category of potential targeted improvements, not revolutionary. There's one question. I see one of the suggestions which got a sort of overwhelming vote of support from respondents was to define or describe operating activities. But we've been in extensive discussions around defining or describing operating profits, which all seems to be very, very difficult. So is describing operating activities in the context of cash flows a sort of different order of challenge, or is it basically the same challenge?
Well, I think it's the same challenge, and I think my views are clear, and I'm not going to waste time giving you my views, because I know that it would raise a lot of disagreement, but I just think it's a notion that is widely used in financial reporting. Most of us have got some sense of what it means, and actually writing it down and wouldn't be the end of the world, even if it doesn't secure total comparability.
Yes, thank you. We support the proposal to align the operating category in the income statement and the cash flow statement. But as of today, there is no operating category in the income statement, so the ISB will probably need to do that. And in doing so, we believe that the ISB should define operating income first and then to consider what should be the corresponding cash flows for the operating category. And therefore, just because operating cash flow is defined today in IS7, that should not be taken as a given.
Russ? I have something similar to Nova, but I would observe that I think if that occurred, that would solve the observation you made regarding financial institutions. I think the reason the statement of cash flows is not used for financial institutions is the primary operations are not in operating cash flow. And so if you did a direct definition of operating cash flow, it would change that the financial would make it more useful. But it is a very difficult judgment to make.
I believe there are other problems, but that's the main mother of all the problems.
Kimberly.
Just sort of responding to the questions that Michelle had in the paper on the first question, very much support the idea of taking the feedback from the FRC DP, which I think has been very helpful in terms of highlighting areas where you can make improvements in the ISB project. Agree, look at where you can align the P&L and the statement of cash flows where that's feasible to do. So that comes back down to our discussions that we've had around how can you define operating profit, etc. But to the extent you can get that alignment, that's obviously going to be useful. Agree with a consistent starting point for the indirect reconciliation of cash flows. It obviously makes sense. Not sure how feasible it will be for the ISB to eliminate options between classification of interest and dividends in the statement of cash flows. I guess some of the things that we've seen here highlight that, and even obviously thinking about different industries. Obviously what works for a bank is not going to work for another type of entity. But I guess that then does leave you with thinking about can you develop some more principle-based guidance to that. So it's not sort of a free-for-all as it is today, but you can achieve greater consistency through that. We also agree with the idea of having a reconciliation where you're using the direct method, reconciling that back to the P&L. That's been a requirement for many years in New Zealand and Australia. We've historically used the direct method of presentation for statement of cash flows. And when we first went onto IFRS, we continued to require the direct method plus a reconciliation. About, I guess, 6 or 7 years ago, we, through a Trans-Tasman harmonisation project, we reinstated the option to use the indirect method, and that has not caused a lot of change. People carry on doing the direct method, and I guess there are historical reasons for requiring it. They're similar to what the ISB found in its previous project on reporting financial performance, and that users say that actually the direct method is more useful. Now, while I'd like to think that companies agree with that and that's why they're carrying on doing it, I suspect it's, and this is my speculation, that it's more inertia than anything else, that having been doing it that way, they carry on doing it. But nevertheless, that is what happens. In terms of where the reconciliation is presented, we don't currently specify where to put it, and we do see some companies presenting it following the statement, so they'll have the statement of cash flows and then they'll have the reconciliation, whereas others will put it in the notes. And we obviously, for that reason, for what our practices, we would not support getting rid of the direct method, eliminating that option. We think that would be a step backwards. Notwithstanding, we typically don't like options. We think the direct method's a better option, so it wouldn't make sense to eliminate it. So on your second question around other comments, we sort of echo comments around it will be challenging for the ISB to define operating activities positively. Agree, understand the thinking as to why you might want to do that, but I agree that will be a challenge and therefore likely to keep it as a residual category. And also support the idea about having taxation separately. I think that's going to be a useful approach. Well, I guess those are our main comments.
We think that the FRC discussion paper provides the ISB with important input for deciding the objective and the scope of the primary financial statements project. We agree with the ISB staff's plans for considering the feedback on the FRC discussion paper and the analysis in the appendix. The ISB had better to focus on targeted improvement of the statement of financial performance and the statement of cash flows, such as clarifying definition of cash and cash equivalent, and eliminating options for the classification of interest and dividends in the statement of cash flows. Because it seems possible in a short time frame. And we think also with some time frame, the ISB should consider a consistent starting point for the indirect reconciliation of cash flows in conjunction with the definition and the presentation of operating profit in the primary financial statement product. Especially, it needs to be noted that the two reports of New Zealand and UK shows the necessity of definition of operating profit and operating activities. The one thing I'd like to make a comment to the FRC report, actually in the slide 4, the respondents from the user group is very small, very small number. Only 4 from among 22. So I think we need to focus on the user's voice, what they think about in this context. So do you have in mind something to do more to collect the opinions from the users?
Well, we're not planning to take any further work, to do any further work in this area. I mean, we can always reconsider if somebody suggests that we should. But essentially, this is sort of the handover to ISB and saying, well, this is, we've done what we do, and you take it forward from here. I would comment, though, that as part of developing the paper itself, we talked to users quite extensively, not just in the UK but elsewhere. It wasn't a scientific kind of survey, but we did sound them out. And also the four responses that are from users are from representative groups, so they do represent the views of many people. And they are quite large and thoughtful responses, at least two or three of them are, but I won't in a public meeting identify which those two or three are, because that would identify the rest.
You.
Okay, thank you. First of all, we agree with that the cash flow statement is very important and the improvements should be considered, which was mentioned in the slide 5. And we also think that the FRC's research is a very helpful input to this project. I have a very general comment, that is, we generally agree with the Japanese colleagues that maybe we should take the performance statement, this project, into account, because the cash flow statement, maybe the structure, the content and the presentation, maybe it should will be aligned with the performance statement. So we agree with Japanese colleagues' comments. And for some specific items, we have 3 points. The first one is with regard to the adjustment starting point for the cash flow arising from the indirect method. In the slide 6 also mentioned that. In our opinion, that a clear definition of the starting point item is very important, because it starting from the undefined item will lose the comparability of the financial statement. That's our concern. Since we don't have agreement on the operating profit or EBITDA, since we don't have EBITDA operating a profit defined in the financial statement, then currently we use the net profit as the starting point. But maybe in the future, if we successfully defined operating profit, then maybe we should use the operating profit as the starting point for the cash flow. And if we decide to define EBITDA or EBIT as a subtotal of the performance statement, we think maybe we should use EBITDA or EBIT as the starting point from the for the cash flow. That should be aligned with each other. That's the first point. The second point is on the purchase of the PPE. In China, we also have mixed views from different constituents. Currently, we think we have 3 categories for the cash flow: operating, investment, and financing. Maybe we should take the industry that the enterprise was in taking into consideration. And at the same time, we just are talking about the purchase of the PPE. How about the disposal of the PPE? Should it be aligned with the purchase? So maybe we should also take this into consideration. That's the first, second point. The third point is about the ISP's tentative decision on eliminating options for the classification of interest and dividends in the statement of cash flows. Just a very quick question. In our opinion, it's not very clear that this kind of activity should be included in operating or financing, because you just said eliminating the options. But we are wondering which category it should go in, operating or financing. And at the same time, we should also take into account the interest and dividends received. Should it be in operating or in investment? So that's the third point. That's all. Thank you.
On the subject of the direct methods versus the indirect methods, we rather informally raised this point with our analysts, and most, if not all, they were in favor of the indirect method. Much to my surprise, but they were in favor of the indirect method. And most of the Italian companies produce cash flow statement using the indirect method. Of course, I agree with the suggestion made to the board to better define or define what is the operating profit in order that there are a common starting point. And when you do that, company will start having adjusted operating profit.
Okay. Well, this is 1 minute extra coffee time. 2 minutes.